Olivia. Representative Gordon Hintz has represented the 54th Assembly District, that's Oshkosh. His first election was in 2006, so he's a veteran member of the Assembly, but his role changed. Now he's the Assembly Democratic leader, so Representative Hintz, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
In your September 8th letter to your comrades saying, well, I'd like to be leader, you wrote, I'm just going to read one sentence, the past 8 years have seen Democrats lose over 1,000 legislative seats across the country. Why have Wisconsin Assembly Democrats lost 17 seats in the last four elections?
Well, I think part of it is the challenge that's happened nationally. I mean, I included that not to make excuses for what's happened in Wisconsin, but rather to say it's one of the challenges that's facing a number of states. I mean, even Minnesota and Iowa, they lost seats in the last election. We've seen other states with similar demographics, go through some challenging times. And my message to my colleagues is, you know, that is what we're up against, but in Wisconsin, I have to say, we have the most partisan redistricting in U.S. history, perhaps, and that's going to go to the Supreme Court.
October 3rd?
Yep, and there's been a number of other decisions, but I'm not here to make excuses. I'm here to challenge my colleagues to step up and say, no one's going to hand it to us. You know, we've got to find a way to get back out there, and I think, you know, with a time when Republicans' popularity is at an all-time low, we've got opportunity in 2018 that we need to be ready for that I don't feel at this time we are.
Well, talk about the U.S. Supreme Court hearing. How much of your hopes are you pinning on the U.S. Supreme Court ordering the drawing of new lines in Wisconsin in time for the 2018 elections?
I think we need to be ready for whatever the lay of the land is. Obviously, that would present tremendous opportunity. I think it would be the right decision. I would hope that we'd have a ruling by the end of the year, and that would be great. But the reality is we have to work with what we know the world is now and what it could be, and that's working with existing maps, trying to recruit candidates, and trying to get a message out there that is not just critical of what's been happening under Governor Walker the last 7 years, but a message that resonates with voters about how Wisconsin can do better. I think that's part of the challenges when you're a party in opposition in the minority is you got to give people an alternative that they can understand.
But you've been in office a number of terms, so you realize there's four elements to a re-election. You know, there's the district, and then there's fundraising, and then there's messaging, and the candidates who are recruited. How are you going to be able to manage that, or which of those are you going to take over, and which are you going to delegate?
Well, I plan on delegating. One of the reasons I said that I would be willing to step up, and I think I'm in a position to do this. It feels right given where I am. You know, there's members that have been in longer than me, who I know well. There's members and my colleagues that are new. And where I am generationally, I think I've got an opportunity to challenge my colleagues to recommit, to take on a better, a bigger role. And to make sure that we're doing everything we can to be successful. You got to take care of your district first, but I do plan on delegating, meaning I wasn't interested in doing everything myself or calling all the shots. And I think too often people retreated, got frustrated. It's certainly been a demoralizing time, and we're not going to be successful if we continue to count on one or two people to carry the load.
Well, this is my term and not yours. Was it a generational coup that led to your being elected leader?
I don't think it had to do with a single issue, or a single vote, or a single person. Peter led us Democrats during one of the most difficult times, during one of the most contentious times in state history, and that was not easy. And holding us together was, you know, an important part. And I mentioned earlier we faced redistricting. We faced changes to campaign finance law and a number of other things that were written by the people that will benefit the most, and some national wave cycles that, you know, have made it difficult. That being said, we have a lot of new members with turnover, with new members coming in that I think, aren't necessarily as invested as they need to be to feel like they're part of something. And so whether it was anybody's fault or not, I think there was frustration, a disengagement that, you know, led a lot of people to think that, you know, we need to recommit ourselves, get some new leadership in there, and move forward in a way that puts us in a position to be more successful electorally in 2018.
How's your style different than Peter? One thing that I'm going to observe is you seem to have a little bit quicker on the temper than Mr. Barca. Maybe that's an unfair description. Correct me if I'm wrong. You can get excited on finance.
Finance is a different thing. I mean, there's a little bit of a theater element when you're making an argument. I say most of the time if I'm upset, it's because I'm upset. I don't do false rage well. But I'm in a different position now, and I represent my caucus, and I want to listen to what the concerns are, and I want to put our members in a position to be successful. My job is to put forward a plan that my colleagues can buy into and understand that'll be tied to the narrative that we are trying to use to reach voters across the state. I want to move away from chasing economic populism exclusively or identity politics exclusively and get back to some of the bigger ideas that are value-based that I think can appeal to all voters.
Is income inequality one of those, Representative?
Certainly, but I think you have to talk about it in the right way. I think economic security overall is something that people are concerned about, and sometimes that manifests itself in resentment or bitterness and sometimes fear. But I think you have to have a future-oriented narrative that people can understand and is actually, compelling. Otherwise, people that talk about the past and bringing back this or bringing back that always is going to trump something that maybe people can't imagine.
There's a list, I've made a list, of 40 or 50 major changes that the Republicans have enacted since they took office in January of 2011. And you've been there for all of them. Could you list those changes, the ones, two or three of those that you consider most damaging to the state of Wisconsin?
Sometimes when I look back at all of the things that have happened, if you had told me that we were going to have statewide taxpayer-funded private education, I mean, it is the largest entitlement program created in Wisconsin
Choice.
Ever.
Yep.
Those types of things, when you look at, we have a fixed pot of money, and we've expanded what state government is ultimately doing programmatically, and that takes money out of the programs. I think that is something, given its continued direction, has started us in a trend where we are now supporting two systems of education that we simply can't afford. The redistricting decision, given that it's certainly enabled and allowed for the type of disparity that you've seen the majority be able to have. I mean, I came in my first term when we had divided government, mm-hmm. but it was 52-47 in the assembly, and there were more moderates in between, and there was governing that could happen as people were more willing to break from their party. These days, when you have 64 seats and the kind of differences, I think that it's harder to find some middle ground, even if some of their members break off. Certainly, a lot of the environmental legislation and just the undermining of the DNR overall, I think, is a dramatic change. I mean, if you had said in the 1990s, during the Thompson administration, that in 20 years, Wisconsin was going to turn its back on investing in transportation infrastructure, was going to dismantle the national model, the DNR, for protecting natural resources, and that we were going to turn our back on public education and public schools for the most part. Those are things that Republicans and Democrats had spent the 20th century building up. Didn't belong to anybody. We usually argued on different issues or around the margins of those issues. It's dramatically different now.
Where does Act 10 rank on your list of odious things that the Republicans have done as a Democrat?
I think it ranks incredibly high, not just because it was to my newspaper, the Oshkosh Northwestern, that Governor Walker was asked if he was going to sit down and negotiate with workers. He said, yes, I'm going to do this through tough negotiations. The men and women who work in corrections at Winnebago Mental Health in my district, many of them who supported him, feel completely betrayed. I mean, I think people misunderstand. The recall wasn't about issues. It was about the fact that the governor lied to the voters, and the recourse available for people when you have somebody lie to the voters before an election is a recall.
Why can't your party beat him in 2010, 2012, 2014? And why will your party beat him, you hope, in 2018?
Sure. I will say this. I mean, the governor is an effective politician. He's a different kind of politician. I think where you saw Governor Doyle and Governor Thompson, certainly make a play for middle-of-the-road voters. Governor Walker, he gets 52%. He really plays to the right and doesn't seem to care. I'll say this. Governor Walker is running for president still. I think a lot of the policies, whether it's not solving our transportation crisis or some being wedded to some ideological thing, seem to be more driven towards any sort of future appeal for consideration at on the national scene. 2014, it was a midterm election nationally. It wasn't particularly good for Democrats. Of course, 2016 wasn't good for Democrats either. So some of it has to do with the wave election. I think that the recall election may have gotten in the mind of some voters as, well, let's give the guy a second term. He got interrupted. But now we've got an 8-year record, right? And for the last 3 budgets, the governor's failed to address transportation. We're delaying projects. We're driving up the cost to taxpayers. We're borrowing a record level of transportation money. And that problem only gets worse. We're still paying for massive tax cuts that have led to slow, if not anemic, economic growth. And now he's doubling down with his signature initiative, which is sort of a microcosm of everything he's ever done. He's going to give away, at 100% taxpayer risk, up to $3 billion, the largest public subsidy of a foreign company in U.S. history.
If Foxconn wanted to build in Outagamie, Winnebago, or Final Act counties, would you have voted for that deal?
I think that's a challenging, consideration. I recognized, where my colleagues were, who I think were torn between the hopes of some of these things. I mean, it's hard because I think one of the big concerns, along with cost, along with risk, is also how feasible this project is. I mean, the governor says ground is going to break. It's going to be open by 2020. I heard the other day it's going to take 4 or 5 years for them to be able to hook up the water and have the capacity of the treatment plant to even deal with this. We didn't include any money in the budget to be able to, recognize the 10,000 construction workers that were going to be there next year. So is this going to happen like the governor says? And if so, why aren't we recognizing that or reflecting that in the budget? So I think locally it's portrayed differently. I can tell you what the viewpoint has been in Oshkosh and other places around the state. I mean, we had a meeting at our chamber the other day, and small business said, look, these guys don't care about the local community. They don't care about their workers. I mean, during the recession, one of my small businesses said, we cut hours back to 36 hours a week so we could maintain our workforce because we didn't want to lay anybody off because we were going to need them. We work with local suppliers. We invest in the community. You're not going to get that with a foreign company who is cutthroat in their, trying to extract as much as they can out of government entities and for purely driven by profit. So I think there's a lot of pressure maybe in those local communities. It's hard to consider since it's such a bad deal to anybody who doesn't have skin in the game. If you look at what nationally economists and business analysts are saying, I mean, they're pointing out that this deal doesn't make any sense.
If you're the majority leader after the 2018 elections, and that's a big if, and I understand that, would you push the governor, or would you push a bill repealing the Foxconn deal? Would you try to undo it, or is it going to be put in, locked up in a contract that you don't know if you'd be able to undo it?
I think it's hard to do hypotheticals with this. And look, if we are going to go forward, and I certainly supported trying to improve it, I hope it works out beyond expectations. And when they first made the announcement, I thought, this is exciting. A new emerging technology company was choosing Wisconsin. I think it was something that, this is an exciting thing. But the devil really was in the details. And when you say to yourself, well, what is the opportunity cost of $3 billion over 15 years and a 25-year payback? We've had a lot of CEOs that have been speaking out about what we could do to grow existing small businesses that are short on capital, or new entrepreneurs that are probably going to be responsible for many of the jobs of tomorrow. It's hard to look at this. I mean, if you focus on the jobs thing, people kind of get carried away. But if you focus on what the costs is, I think increasingly Wisconsinites are skeptical, especially about those that have been frustrated about an economy that increasingly doesn't work for them.
A year from now, if Foxconn has broken ground and it's under construction and they've hired 300 or 400 people, doesn't that significantly hurt your party's ability to use that as an argument, Representative?
If I thought Foxconn was a good deal, I would have gotten behind the deal. I would have been happy. I've had good conversations with Mark Hogan from WEDIC and from Secretary Neitzel. I tried to do my work vetting this thing, but it's not a good deal. And it's not accountable, and those are the decisions that we have to make when we're representing our taxpayers. My guess is we'll be arguing about the merits of Foxconn. If nothing happens next year, the governor is going to waive it and say, well, if I'm not governor, it's not going to happen. And he may know that it's never going to happen. I have no idea. You know, maybe this is just the issue he needs to get him through 2018. But, you know, it might be a decade that we're looking at. I mean, when I think it was Tim Sheehy from you know, the Metropolitan Milwaukee Area Business Council, who said if half of what they're talking about happens, it'll be great. You know, I don't know that the rest of us have determined what does success look like, especially when it comes to jobs, when it comes to cost, and when it comes to opportunity cost.
One third or more of your caucus is from Milwaukee. How important is the city, and in terms of the next election and some of the urban issues? Will that be part of your messaging? What has happened to Milwaukee? Will that issue play in Marathon and Douglas County?
Well, we need it to. I think too many of the issues that have come up in the state are portrayed in a way that divide us. I mean, you know, if you look like issues like Black Lives Matter or immigration, if you break them down to what they're actually about, it's about people want to be safe. People want to be secure. It's not about giving special treatment or portraying one side against the other. But the reality is the state can't be strong without its biggest city and its biggest economic development engine being strong. I think one of the things I look forward to working with the other side on is really trying to address the urban-suburban divide that has plagued the Milwaukee metro area for a long time, whether it's transportation or the spatial mismatch between available jobs and available labor. You know, it's there's a lot of history there, but I think it's in everybody's best interest for the best of the for the good of the state to move forward.
There's no, as you said, there's no long-term transportation funding in the budget. But Representative Cuenca said this to you, Representative Hitz, you've never offered a long-term transportation funding plan. Close quote. Was he right?
I mean, last year we said, would you guys be willing to reinstate gas tax indexing so we at least don't fall any further behind on inflation? And we couldn't even get Representative Cuenca to move an inch on it. Once we saw that, the question is, what do you want to put out there? I'm already on record saying I support increased revenue because I think it's more financially responsible to pay for roads than it is to borrow, drive up costs, spend money on maintenance on roads that you're only ultimately going to fix. The idea that they said no new taxes, no new fees, and then decided to target disproportionately high electric vehicles and hybrids, I think, you know, that was a solution to their budget problem. It wasn't a solution to transportation in the long term. And so I'm happy to get together. I've talked to the governor saying we'd be willing to work together to provide some votes. We know that there's some tough lifting politically because it's always tough to raise revenue, whether that's fees or taxes. But we are going to be in such a bad position because of the financial mismanagement and the failure of leadership of this governor. And it is on him. I mean, since 2013, they have punted. It's expensive, it's inefficient, and it's a waste of taxpayer money. And
is that your top campaign issue approaching a year from now?
I think it is the clearest issue.
Sorry for interrupting.
No. I mean, there are two issues when it comes to transportation. Good infrastructure is essential to a good economy in Wisconsin. The cost is one issue, but to me, it's the biggest demonstration of what a failed leader Governor Walker has been. How can you have three straight budgets of, they've included three studies in their budgets. I think the governor got rid of one study, so maybe he heard my criticism of him. I think he was going to veto one of the studies on tolling. But how can you not address the issue that you've known about for 6 years when you keep borrowing money, you keep delaying projects, and the numbers from his own agency about what the conditions of our roads are going to be and what the cost of inaction is, I mean, the next governor is going to have to clean up such a mess that the legacy of this governor would be the dismantling of an infrastructure system that's had such a negative impact on economic growth.
But let's look at the next year Democratic election hierarchy. Re-elect Senator Baldwin, elect a Democratic governor. Senator Schilling would like a majority in the Senate, and you want to move up significantly your 35-member caucus. Are you going to have the funds to be able to do that in terms of, I just listed your priority as number four. Maybe it's unfair, but is it unfair to list it as number four in that Baldwin, Gov, Senate, Assembly?
Well, look, if Senator Baldwin does well and the Democratic candidate for governor does well, then I think the state Senate Dems and the Assembly Dems are also going to do well. I think the coordinated campaign is going to be important. I'm someone, at least in my area, who tries to drive the train by having local volunteers that's most connected, that does doors in their own district to build the campaign from the bottom. I think that's how you get people involved. Our goal is to raise enough money to be competitive, to back candidates that are willing to do the work that we think are effective in seats that we can win. But I also would like to field candidates in all 99 seats. Again, at some point in this state's history, you know, we have had Democrats be successful. And I think one of the questions is, did the transition that we saw in the last election led by Donald Trump, was that one time? Was it a permanent change, a semi-permanent change? And can we reach the voters that either didn't turn out or maybe that, you know, voted for Donald Trump and down ticket? Assembly Democratic candidates that we had last year overperformed the Republican candidates. I mean, the majority of them beat Hillary Clinton, beat Russ Feingold in some races, but obviously fell short because of the wave that took place. We need to keep it closer, but some of those things were out of our control. Again, my goal as leader is to try to put us in a position where we can be most successful, especially if a lot of things break our way. I don't think anybody knows what kind of year 2018 is going to be yet.
Five or six Democrats have either announced that they're going to run or will be running, one of whom is your good friend, someone you respect, Representative Walks. Have you endorsed him? Are you going to endorse in that race?
I certainly have talked to Dana. I've certainly given my ideas. I like Dana a lot. I think he's doing a great job as candidate, especially with the rollout of everything. I have not endorsed. I think the field is fluid still. I think there's some people that may not be in the race in a few months, and there might be some that get in. And I think increasingly it's a strong field. I think there are candidates in the field now that have a shot at beating Governor Walker, as tough as he's going to be, skilled a campaigner, as much money as he's going to have. But a lot of it is because his record is not, I don't think, isn't going to look so good a year from now. But that's not going to be enough. I mean, I've been encouraging all of us as Democrats that you need to articulate more than what's wrong with what the state is doing. You need to put something out there that resonates with the public, not talking at them, not telling them what you think they need to hear, but by listening to what's important to them, reaching their basic needs, and conveying a message that, you know, really gets them to understand that there are things that we're not doing. There's things that government has a positive role to play in to enhance opportunity in all parts of the state. And that's not happening, especially in a lot of rural areas.
I think you just said your Democratic Party brand is not damaged, right? Is it damaged?
Well, I think part of the problem is politics have become national. I mean, the reality, like I said, we had well-funded candidates who worked hard in districts that on paper looked winnable. Chris Dano beat, I think, Hillary Clinton by 9 percentage points
and lost
his seat. I don't know that there's a whole lot we could do about that. And so with politics becoming national, with some of the demographic trends, I think winning the state for Democrat, either U.S. Senate or gubernatorial candidate, is probably easier than imagining an immediate majority in 2 years just because of some of the trends, some of the concentration of voters. But you know, where we've been struggling in some rural areas. We've also been making up in some suburban areas. I think that presents an opportunity that is different than in the past. And, of course, the redistricting decision would change things dramatically. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that we can, you know, we need to prepare for the world as it exists now. My goal is to get everybody dialed in and on the same track again. And if it's going to be a positive year, let's have our sails up and be willing, ready to take advantage of it.
Talk about your personal journey. 2011 doesn't seem to have been your best year, and now we're out 6 years later. The Republicans put out a press release saying, accusing you of a war on women, some of your past activities. How have you changed? How have you grown up politically?
I mean, you know, being in political office isn't always the best place to grow up. It's not the best place to fail. You know, when you fail publicly and you let a lot of people down. But even at that time, I continued to show up. I still stayed committed to the job. You know, I didn't hide, but I realized that I think I was kind of so into the job that I didn't exactly focus on the things that were important in my life. And I really spent a lot of time trying to become a happier person, trying to learn from my mistakes. And hey, look, if I were the Republican Party, they don't have a whole lot to talk about. I mean, you know, they're willing to stand by a governor with a criminal defense fund, a John Doe investigation, a president that brags about sexual assault. I mean, the reality is, that's what they're going to bring out. It's been brought out before. I've been reelected 3 times. I'm going to continue to work hard to serve my constituents. I've certainly apologized for my mistakes. I've learned from them, but I'm not going to apologize for the work that I've done in the last 6 years since then.
How would you characterize your relationship with the Speaker given that incident after the passage of Act 10?
I've always respected Speaker Voss. I mean, look, he's a bright guy. He's done a good job. He runs a tight ship. Like me, I think he served on finance, has an interest in policy and in governance. I look forward to working with him. I've had more conversations with the Majority Leader Steinicke. He's kind of up in my neck of the woods. Michelle Hitchens and I have known each other since 2004. It was an unfortunate incident where, after being awake for 55 hours, you know, you can't use profanity on the floor. It's 100% my fault. I took responsibility for it, but, we've certainly talked since then.
And you said you've apologized for your 2011 decisions that you have changed?
Yeah. I mean, look, if we are going to make people spend the rest of their lives defending every bad decision they've made, every mistake they've ever made, one, there's not going to be a whole lot of people to run for office. And I'm someone who believes you don't have to be defined by all the mistakes that you've made, despite how hard the Republican Party's going to try.
The Bernie Sanders spark, are those passionate idealists going to be some of your candidates? You'd like a candidate in all 99. Are we going to see another bounce back of some Bernie Sanders candidates next year?
Maybe. I mean,
do you hope so?
I guess it depends on the district. I mean, one of the things I mentioned in my speech yesterday, and it's a reminder to my colleagues, there's big diversity among the Democratic Party. And one thing I've learned is, our state has, you know, urban, rural, different parts of the state. In my one term in the majority, we certainly had a lot of colleagues that delivered the majority for us that were from very moderate seats, and they represented their district. I think of Amy Sue Verwink, a good friend of mine from central Wisconsin, big Second Amendment NRA endorsed, you know, candidate, big agriculture representative. Mark Radcliffe, you know, who had Terry Musser's old seat. They could be difficult in a caucus, but they believed in the values that are at the core of the Democratic Party. And one of the things I wanted to stress to my colleagues is, as we try to build on this majority, we got to get away from these purity tests and assume that some sort of economic populism branding is going to be a guarantee everywhere. Or that you can if you just move as far to the left as possible, that's going to be successful. I mean, we want people that are interested in governing. We want people that believe in that government has a positive role to play in expanding opportunity and expanding fairness and investing in communities. And I would take back any of those people who probably gave me headaches at one point in a heartbeat. And so I'm looking for good candidates that can share a vision that reflect the district that they're running in. If that is people who were inspired by Senator Sanders to get involved in politics, you know, that's great. The first thing I always say to people that want to run for office is go talk to some people. Go knock on some doors and just ask them, what are you concerned about? And then think about where you stand on issues. You know, what are the values that you believe in? You know, don't chase things, but you kind of mesh what people, you know, I say you don't pick the issues. There's a lot of things that I'm very interested in that I know my constituents are not as interested in. You don't get to choose the issues, and that's true in 2017. It's been true forever. And so, you know, you want to try to give something to people that best addresses what they're most concerned with, what they're most interested in, and know that you'll effectively represent and try to address that issue.
Okay, almost out of time, so just a couple more questions. Finish this sentence. You will deserve re-election as Democratic leader in December of 18 if?
Well, obviously, if we pick up seats, I think people will feel good. But right now, I'm just concentrating on in the building. I didn't make any promises to people. I didn't say, if you vote for me, I'll give you this, or if you vote for me, I'll give you staff or committee, or, you know, all that. You know, I said, here's what I'm willing to do. I'm going to put myself forward to try to lead us, and we'll know if I'm doing a good job if people are following. I'm not interested in staying minority leader if people aren't on board with what I'm offering for leadership.
Then the final question is whimsy. How did you pick the name Cry Tough for your air guitar?
Oh,
and congratulations on that honor.
Oh, Steve. I know that, you know.
How did you pick the name?
So, you know, the metal fans, your viewers who are fans of the band Poison will know that there was a song called Cry Tough,
okay,
spelled the correct way, but I decided to mix it up a little bit. I think I even added some unnecessary incorrect umlauts on the U on Tough, but it was a shout out to Poison and actually to the metal band
Tough. How do you feel when you see that on YouTube now? Do you wish it was gone?
And not never.
Never? Because yeah. You're quite proud of that?
2006? I was in my late 20s. I mean, look, I've got a sense of humor. I was living in Los Angeles. I got to play the Sunset Strip. I was in a major motion picture. You know, it's one of those things that has come up. I think I'm about every 6 weeks it comes up.
Okay.
So my first, you know, 15 years ago it came up every day. And now I'm about every 6 weeks it gets brought up.
I won't ask about it again, because we're here to talk about your congratulations as Assembly Democratic Leader,
hey.
Representative Gordon Hitz.
Thank you.
54th District, congratulations.
Thanks
for your time. Thank you.